Welcome, welcome, welcome to another edition of Smart Talk. I'm your host, Al Bergeson, and we have a very special guest today. It's Chris Impey, Distinguished University Professor in the Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona. People ask me, they say, Al, do you know Chris? And I say, you know, I don't. I called him on email, and he was wonderful. He responded instantly and said he was glad to do it. You know, folks often think that we should know all each other on faculty, and we probably should, but in point of fact, there are thousands of U of A faculty, and there's also a slight difference between the social scientists, well, actually, it's a large difference, and the natural scientists. Social scientists have been anxious over the years about natural science because in the past, what clearly became social differences like race or gender were often seen as physical differences. And so there is an, I think, unwarranted fear in social science against introducing anything of the natural, the physical, the inherited, the bioendowment, geography, because it would seem to freeze things that are actually flexible amongst people in place because they're natural. There's nothing we can do about them. You could think of an Indian caste system as being part of the larger cosmic order and kept in place, not something that a few Maharajas had put in place over time. Our guest today, Chris Impey, is someone who really works at a wonderful interface of science and society. And I do think that the natural sciences and the social sciences are coming together in areas of interest and importance to all of us. So, Chris, welcome.
Welcome. I'm glad to be here, Al. It's good to be on your show.
It's great to have you. Let me just tell you folks first about Chris's work outside of technical astronomy. He is a wonderful writer of popular books about astronomy and nature in general. His most recent one is called Einstein's Monsters, The Life and Time of Black Holes. It just came out in paperback. It's by W.W. Norton. And Chris has quite a wide range of interests that he has. Here's another of his book, Humble Before the Lord, A Western Astronomer, His Journey East and a Remarkable Encounter Between Western Science and Tibetan Buddhism. We get a chance, we're going to talk to Chris about that. So let's start off with something that's both contemporary and interestingly science. As we are in this present epoch where we talk about fake news, fake science, not real, hacking by foreign countries with made-up stories, it's very hard on the internet where more and more people, particularly young people, go for information about science. And so Chris and some other scholars are working on an app and a way to detect fake science. It sounds fascinating. Chris, tell us a little about what you guys are up to.
Sure. This stems from the larger issue of great concern of fake news, which, you know, has bubbled up in the last few years. And the gatekeepers, it used to be simple when there were a few TV networks and you got your news from the main networks, when people read textbooks and that's how they got their information on a subject, then there were gatekeepers to knowledge and arbiters to knowledge, and you really didn't have many choices. Now there's the internet, there's social media, and it's a wild west. So we're trying to use a technology approach, not to suppress bad science or fake science, but to let people really easily flag it on their web browser so they don't stumble into it without knowing.
That would seem like an almost impossible task to decide whether if someone quoted numbers or quoted journals or quoted authorities. Yeah. It seems very rarefied to tell what's fake and what's not. How are you guys trying to be something that doesn't end up being sort of a joke or just they can dismiss as, oh, they're just pushing back by calling it fake science, but it's real? What becomes the secret sauce that makes this thing worth doing?
You're right. It's hard. I mean, it's fun and it's hard. And research is usually like that. It's both. So in this case, our test bed, you know, we pick a subject where people care a lot, which is climate change. So you have to start by training. A neural net is just a set of computer algorithms mimicking the brain, and it doesn't have intelligence. It doesn't have, you know, real mind. So you have to train it. And so what we start with is smart undergrads or grad students, and they go out on the internet and they curate or select a few hundred articles that are legitimate climate science, popular articles, not technical, and then they go to the underbelly of the internet and find the climate science denier articles. And as you suggest, some of them are very well written. They use the same jargon. You know, if you didn't know the subject, you might be fooled. So those fake and real training sets are what let the neural net decide what assertions are justified by evidence and what are not. And that's the distinguishing mark of science.
Are there real climate scientists who deny, not deny, but diminish the importance of climate change? That is all putting down the horrors of climate change just deniers and fake news? Is there a real science about this?
No, there's a minority view. I mean, the simple number that I've seen, and it's justified by surveys, is that essentially 95-97% of professional trained climate scientists adhere to the position that the Earth is warming and we're the cause, the primary cause, if not the sole cause. But there is a small minority view that says that some of the other factors that affect climate have been underestimated. They don't deny humans' impact, but they say, no, we've overplayed that factor. So they're not denying it absolutely. They're just saying, well, it's a little more complicated and you don't really understand it, and the human part may be not as large. But they're really in a small minority. The models are very simple. If you put in and then take out the human impact by carbon emissions, it makes essentially the whole effect of warming.
Let me just take the other side for half a second, play the devil's advocate. Ice ages have come and gone. And we are due, in some sense, for another ice age if the past continues. Mm-hmm. Would the presence of another ice age for God knows how long invalidate the notion of global warming, or would global warming be such that we wouldn't get another ice age?
Okay, to the second part, yes, it's possible that we could alter the underlying dynamics of the Earth's climate so that an ice age is headed off, if you like, by technology. That's essentially what we'd have done. But more generally, it is an important point, and people have said this. Sometimes they're trying to rebut our effect on the climate. They say, well, you know, the Earth has been a lot colder and a lot hotter, and there are ice ages, and, you know, like, what's the big deal? Well, yes, but those play out over tens of thousands of years, and they are natural effects on the climate. What's happened since the Industrial Revolution is dramatic. It's happening on a timescale 100 times shorter than geological timescales that are indeed natural and cause large swings. So yes, the Earth has been a lot colder and a lot hotter in the past naturally, and that would happen if we weren't here. But we are putting our finger on the scales. We're putting a big ham fist on the scales very, very quickly.
Yes. Smart Talk with Al. A call-in number, 790-2040. We're going to be talking about astrobiology and the search for life outside of Earth, the possibility of habitable planets. We're going to be wondering about what in God's name is dark matter. At least I'm going to wonder. Chris is my authority. We got here. Black holes and loads of other kinds of things. So please give us a call and ask any kind of question you want. We're very lucky to have Chris Impey, a distinguished astronomer from the U of A, here with us today. Have we done any trial runs? Oh, also, you had said in the little blurb about what you were doing that there's an app on your phone. Now, is the idea that somehow if I get an article, I can submit it to a review by the app or screen it? Or how does this thing practically work?
There's not an app yet. It will be by the end of this year. So there are two things. There's going to be a browser extension, just a thing you would put in, you know, attached to your browser. And that will, if you go to a science site, it will toss up a color-coded, you know, green to red indicator of whether that science site you're on is a legit site or not. So that's one thing, just helping to guide you. And if you go to a bad site and it's flashing red, it'll point you to a better source for that information. The smartphone app will take a little longer, probably not till the end of the year. And that's, yes, we're going to try and crowdsource it. So we'll have people who are interested in classifying articles themselves. So we'll pop up like Tinder, you know, it'll throw up articles unattributed, so you don't know where they came from, short articles, and you can swipe left for that's fake, or right for that's real, or up for I don't know. And we'll help make the neural net smarter, in fact. So we'll have people, and you can gamify it. You can compete against your friends to see who's better at classifying fake and real science or distinguishing them.
Has it crossed your minds, it probably has, that the other side might do the same thing? And tied to that, is there any concern that somehow there's a pre-screening of things that thought control is too strong? Don't get me wrong. But somehow that a bunch of students have decided what you can and can't read. Again, that's too strong. Mm-hmm. But I can just see people go, Rush Limbaugh and others going nuts saying, you know, what this guy Impey and others are up to is trying to control what opinions you read about science.
Right. So it's a legitimate concern. And part of it, I think the underlying fact that makes it legitimate and takes away that concern is the way these neural nets work and what these tools are doing is they're getting to the core of the scientific method without regard to what the subject matter is or whether it's political or apolitical or scientific or anything. They're looking for anything that's a claim or an assertion. You know, this is a fact. I'm saying this is the case. This happens. And then they're looking somewhere else in the article or even on the internet for evidence that supports that claim.
Gotcha.
So it's claim evidence pairs, and the neural net is looking for that coupling. So if you make an assertion that has no evidence to support it in the article or anywhere, then that's going to be downgraded.
So it's not opinions that are being evaluated, but it's do you do this? I claim X about the world,
right?
But I have no evidence that I do about the world to do. All right, we just got a signal. We got to take a break. Stay with us, folks. 790-2040 is the number to call in. We're going to be right back with astronomer Chris Impey. We're back. I'm bumbling around here in the morning. Smart Talk with Al on KVOY 1030 on your AM dial right here from the Bustos studio in Tucson, Arizona. Our guest today is Chris Impey, professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona. We have a caller. Mary, you're on the air. What's your question for Chris?
Hey, Al. My question for Chris is, what's the likelihood that another extrasolar asteroid would do something erratic, like strike our sun and end all life on Earth as we know it?
Right. And let me add to that for Chris to talk about and strike the sun and also strike the Earth and make us into dinosaurs.
I want to reassure you. Thanks for the question, Mary. Yes, an asteroid or any big rock striking the sun, actually not a worry at all, because the sun is huge, and so it would just swallow up the asteroid and say thanks very much and give a little burp and maybe shine a little brighter for a little while. But if it hit the Earth, obviously a big problem. So the question there is, how often does it happen? And if it were to happen, or we saw signs of it happening, could we do anything about it? And actually, good news on both fronts on the how often it happens. A dinosaur-killing asteroid impact or any impact is about every 100 million years. Dinosaurs died 65 million years ago. That doesn't mean we have 35 million years to go. It's random, so it could happen sooner. But that's a pretty long time span. On the worry list, it should be way down there. And if we were to find a rock that we thought was heading towards the Earth, I mean, space is big, the rocks are big, but space is vast, so the odds of an impact are actually really low. And we just track it and get an orbit. And if it really were headed towards us, we actually have methods to send spaceships out to attach rockets to the asteroid and just use little booster jets to steer it away from the Earth. And that technology has actually been tested because we've landed on asteroids and comets. So we know we could do this. We'd have a few years of notice and we could do it. It'd be very exciting to watch it happen, but we could save the Earth.
You know, science fiction is slowly eroding, and reality of dealing with outer space is slowly increasing. Mary, that's a great question. Thank you.
Thank you, Al. Thank you, Chris.
Yes,
okay.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Thanks for calling in. One quick follow-up on the neural net way to detect science. Chris said, and then Chris, give me a quick comment after this, that you are building in ways that when you get in words, I think, I feel, those will be separated from fact claims. Explain that for a pinch.
Yes. So the neural nets we're working with were developed by Google, which used, you know, a huge body of data to do a language model, basically make a language model for all words and how they're used on any topic. And so the neural net, you know, can easily distinguish between opinions and assertions of fact. And in our neural net, technology is only going to look for things that are assertions of fact and then look for whether those assertions are backed up by evidence anywhere in the article itself or elsewhere on the internet. And that's what it's going to look for. So it'll just skate over anything that's just an opinion or a feeling or a judgment call or something that you know, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not to your own facts. I think someone said that, and I can't remember who.
That's a classic line, isn't it? Let's switch to something that is really exciting, and that is the astrobiology, which is an emerging science about, I guess, living material from everything from just, I guess, complex molecules to actual aliens, which we would call them because they weren't from Earth, or other kinds of beings, and the search for life elsewhere in the universe. You're up on this kind of stuff. Give us a short rendition of what we're doing and what's the chances we might find something, and what might that look like?
Sure. It's a big subject. It's one of the most dynamic areas of science, astrobiology. And I'll give an advanced plug for a free College of Science lecture we're having. I'm one of the two lecturers, and a young a female researcher in astrobiology is the other, on the 4th of February in Centennial Hall. And it's about life beyond Earth. So if you want a quick primer for an hour on an evening on February 4th, then that's a good lecture. Basically, the expectation is that there's life beyond the Earth, but we have no evidence of it. So what's new is that in the last decade, we found that there are many, many planets out there. That's a very successful part of astronomy, to find planets around other stars. And it's gone so well that we've now found hundreds of Earth-like planets, many of which are habitable in the sense that they're at the right distance from their other stars, distant from our own sun, for water to be on their surfaces, and they probably have atmospheres. We don't know what the atmospheres are, and we don't know much about these planets except their size and their mass. So we're literally finding hundreds of habitable worlds out there, and it leads to the expectation, like, wow, what are the odds that they're all dead? Now, how does science answer the question of whether they're dead or not? And that turns out to be much harder to say that than to just say, here's a planet, we found one around another star. But it's sort of framing the question, and astronomers are now on the lookout for how to measure whether there's life on a distant Earth-like planet.
There's evidently, again, correct me, I'm not the expert, you are, determination of water beneath the ground on, I think, Mars, and mm-hmm. on the two poles of of the moon.
Right.
Has it gone any further in terms of rover-like analysis? Although I presume pretty soon there will be human colonies on Mars, at least science stations like in Antarctica, that have hinted that there is other elements within the water that might suggest there was or still is.
So life. Yes. So the planet, the exoplanets, as they're called, extrasolar planets, this is burgeoning area of science. These are all pretty far away. They're tens, hundreds of light years. That's hundreds of trillions of miles. So they're far. But it's, as you say, there's still a fair question of whether there's life in the solar system beyond the Earth. Mars is the best bet. It's the closest planet for us to get to. And Mars' surface is almost certainly sterile because there's no atmosphere, UV radiation, cosmic rays. It's blasted, and it's cold as well. But under the surface is likely to be water right now as we speak. And we see evidence in the distant past that Mars had shallow bodies of water on it, so probably had a thicker atmosphere and was warmer. So yes, Mars very probably had microbial life billions of years ago, and it might still have microbial life in subsurface aquifers. The frustrating thing, when you mentioned the rovers, is that our technologies are just a little too primitive to dig that out soon, because these rovers, these very smart rovers we send, they sort of scratch around on the surface. I think they can only go down 10 centimeters by digging. Aquifers with real water now are probably tens of meters, hundreds of meters deep, and we can't get to them. So we're going to need to be there. We'll probably need astronauts there. We'll need a colony or a base there to do real exploration of life on Mars.
Similarly, our asteroids, and the Japanese have already done they didn't just do a snatch and grab. They did a drop a bomb and stir up the surface and then grab. Give us a quick update for Tucsonans here. How is the Bennu project, for which the U of A is intimately involved in?
Yes.
And for those that don't know, give them a quick sketch, too.
Sure. OSIRIS-REx is it's a U of A, completely U of A-funded mission, a NASA trusting a university to do the entire mission except the launch. And it's going to go to the asteroid Bennu, the near-Earth asteroid Bennu, and pluck a sample off the surface and return it to the Earth in about 5 or 6 years for inspection. Now, Bennu, or OSIRIS-REx, did have a little of its thunder stolen by the Japanese mission that did essentially the same thing last year and is heading their sample back to the Earth. But the truth is, we want more than a couple of these samples. What we might find from such a sample is, asteroids are really small. Nobody really thinks there's life on an asteroid, even fossilized or micro or frozen. But we can certainly find whether all the ingredients for life exist in asteroids, because there's still a question of where the ingredients for life on Earth and elsewhere came from. And their delivery mechanism often involves comets and asteroids. So finding organic material or complex molecules in an asteroid would be very important, or even just frozen water, because they also deliver water to the Earth. There's a question of where the Earth got its oceans, for example. So these are really important experiments for laying down the groundwork for where life came from and where the materials and ingredients for life came from.
You know, astrobiology, the idea of biology, carbon-based, the living things that we know here on planet, do people talk about in any realistic way whether the, I don't know if it's silicon or mechanical, whatever the base is for transformers, the imaginative mechanical creatures, about the foundations for non-carbon-based, life might not be the right word, but things that what are sentient or exist or live or however you want to put it? Or does that seem pretty much will only be like us in a bio sense?
It's a great question, and we don't know the answer. And I think most astrobiologists, or just scientists in general, think it's dangerous to be too myopic about saying that life elsewhere has to look exactly like life on Earth. It leads to a serious issue in this field, because it's easier to look, in a scientific sense, it's easier to frame a hypothesis around something that you know what it is. So if you look for nucleic acids and DNA, you can say you found that or not. But if you don't know what you're looking for, it's very hard to define a scientific experiment to do that. So that's kind of catch 22. But generally, it's possible that biology could have different forms. Chemists have weighed in on silicon. It's in the same part of the column of the periodic table. It has similar properties. It forms complex molecules. But it's slightly inferior. It's kind of a poor cousin of carbon. It forms molecules with weaker bonds. It doesn't form as many different molecules. Carbon is this incredible toolkit for making robust molecules of essentially any size. It's the universal Lego for life. Silicon might work, but it's not going to be as good. And then in the nature of life takes, or nature takes the easiest path, you know, nature is lazy at some level, less energy, less work, then it's going to use carbon, because carbon does things best. It generates complexity more easily, and presumably it generates biology more easily. But that should not rule out other investigation of other possibilities.
As I understand it, some of the moons, the moons of Saturn, maybe it's Jupiter, but have, you know, oceans or whatnot. What's the chance of life from a science point of view beyond Mars in the solar system of moons or planets up until, let's say, Pluto, and then we'll stop there.
Sure. It's an important thing to consider. These are harder places to get to. So, you know, Mars at its closest approach is 50 million miles away. The outer solar system is like 1 billion miles away. So these missions take a decade. You know, we're probably not going to go there with astronauts. So it's harder to do the work, but very interesting places. So around Jupiter is Europa, which is just a water world. I mean, it's a fully water-covered, ice-covered little moon of Jupiter. And absolutely, there's no reason why, if we eventually could make a submersible to investigate those oceans, there's a possibility of biology there. Even more exciting would be around Saturn, so further out in the solar system. Titan is a big moon of Saturn that has an atmosphere as thick as the air we're breathing, made of basically the same thing, nitrogen mostly. But it's very cold, and it has ocean. It has lakes and seas of ethane, methane, a little ammonia, a little water. So if there were life on Titan, it would have a different chemical basis than life on Earth. Very exciting. And so NASA has plans for missions to both of those worlds. It's just expensive, and it takes a decade to do it. So you can't be impatient in this game. It takes a whole career for some investigator to get a mission to their favorite outer solar system world.
Stay with us. We've got to take a break. We're with Chris, here with Chris Impey, Distinguished Professor of Astronomy at the U of A, and we're going to talk more about life out there. Smart Talk with Al. We're back on the air. 790-2040. That's the call-in number, 790-2040. We're here with Chris Impey, astronomy professor at the U of A, talking about life possibilities out in the cosmos. So we've been sticking pretty much to facts and science and whatnot, but let's take a second here on a Saturday morning. And when you wonder or have a glass of wine with colleagues or just shooting the SH, and what do you guys guess might be the way we come to find life, or what's the best prospect for life? And how do you answer the Fermi question? Well, hell, if they're out there, why haven't they come to see us yet?
Right. So when my colleagues and I get together on this, and I think, you know, the work on exoplanet discovery has projected it's only look in our backyard. So you can just extrapolate to about 10 billion habitable worlds just in our galaxy. And so to most astronomers, the odds that we're alone in the universe as a biological world are, you know, that seems very implausible. Also, there's no reason to think we should be the most advanced. You know, why should we be the first if there are all these living worlds to get technology and spacecraft and telescopes and so on and learn about our place in the universe? So most astronomers also think that's unlikely, and that, you know, then it's just game on, because, and that's Fermi's question. So Fermi asked that in 1950, very prescient to frame a question like that before the space age, essentially. And he knew that the ingredients for life were widespread, that it's likely someone could get more advanced than us and be traveling through space in the galaxy or exploring it. And so where are they? And it's a fair question. It's a well-posed question, as they say in philosophy. And so astronomers, everyone has their own answer to that question. One possibility is we really are unique, or it's very rare to have intelligent life, and so we're just isolated. The galaxy is a huge place. And another possibility, a little less favorable to us, is that they're out there and they don't care because we're so primitive compared
to... We're not even worth conquering.
Yeah, that we're primitive to them as we would consider a microbe or a fungus on a rock. You know, why would we care? Why would we want to talk to that? And so our sense of self, our self-opinion and our self-worth is tied up in this question.
So the bottom line, I suppose, is we basically really don't know. No. But it is amazing, I must say, just following the news, how much more almost monthly or yearly, more exoplanets, more of them in the sweet spot where you could have life. It's just increasing. We've got a caller. Philip, you're on the air. You got a question for Chris.
Yes. If any form of life is discovered on Mars, wouldn't that make it off limits for humans to go there because they would contaminate it?
Yeah, it's a good question. NASA has taken this idea of contamination very seriously. So starting about a decade ago, NASA put in place a policy where when we send spacecraft there, they essentially sterilize themselves so that they don't dump terrestrial microbes on Mars. We want a clean experiment. So it's a good question. Equally, when we bring back Mars rocks, there's very serious protocols for not putting germs on the Earth. So remember, if you can recall, the moon rocks went to Johnson Space Center and they sat in a level 4 biohazard containment facility. That's what you'd use for Lassa fever and dengue fever and so on. And that's where we'll keep Mars rocks too. So contamination is a real issue. We don't want to go to Mars and mess up the detection of what life might be there.
Wasn't there something that one of the astronauts, cosmonauts who went to the moon recently, they've discovered some kind of, I don't know, not dandruff, but something growing or something left over that probably came from something human being there? I thought I read that somewhere.
Well, there are very interesting things that have happened about the robustness of even more than microbial life. I think the most exciting was that there most people are familiar with tardigrades, a kind of middle school science experiment, water bears, I guess they're called. And they're not microbes. They're real creatures, you know, with legs and internal organs. They're tiny. They're millimeter size. Well, tardigrades managed to survive on a Russian spacecraft that went to the space station and was in the harsh vacuum of space for weeks and then came back to the Earth. So you know, if not microbes, but at real critters, if you like, very small ones, can survive those conditions, then that's very interesting. That means life might move around the solar system or maybe beyond and survive the harsh conditions of space before it gets to a more hospitable environment.
Well, it would be encouraging if larger biological units like humans could have the same luck. We've got another caller, Mr. Stu. You on the air? Question for Professor Impey.
Good morning. Thank you for your contribution. This is fascinating. Have you ever read a book called Death on Mars?
No, I haven't. I've read a lot of Mars books, but not that one.
This is by the PhD scientist in plasma. There are two places on Mars where it looks like there was really big explosions on opposite sides of the planet that just wasted the whole place. It seems to be evidence that there's life and intelligent life, which is occasionally hostile. I would pick it up. It's a great book. It killed an airplane flight to South Africa for me once. It was a fascinating book. Thank you.
Okay, I'll check it out. I'll make the comment, though, that may not be, I mean, that's a one interpretation. Mars is a violent place. It's not geologically active now, but it has the biggest volcano in the solar system, even though it's a rather small planet. And so there have been violent, explosive geological events on Mars that have nothing to do with intelligent life on Mars in its past. And we do see evidence of that.
You know, we're talking about meteorites hitting Earth and whatnot. Do you have an opinion on the debate between whether it was volcanic activity in around India and the Indian Ocean versus an asteroid hit in Yucatan that kicked up enough goop that ended the dinosaur extinction?
I've been following that debate, and it's fascinating. It used to be seemed like such a simple story. You know, we've seen this crater off the Yucatan. It was a large impact. It's the right time for the dinosaur and other species extinction. About 30% of all large species died quickly. But it now is clear that there was a massive volcanic episode. So it looks like life suffered a 1-2 punch, and the things were unrelated. They happened within less than a million years of each other. But it's fairly clear that you can't solely attribute that mass extinction to the impact. It something else was going on too. That, you know, when massive volcanic episodes happen, they can have just as devastating effects on the food web as an impact.
So, talking about small creatures leaving Earth and surviving, and talking about the possibility of life outside, brings me to the topic of UFOs the constant thing is, why don't we see them? Why don't they ever visit? Why do they always visit, you know, rural people in the South? And terrible things people say like that. There's been that recent YouTube picture of the Navy pilots with this little spot moving, and I'm sure you've seen. Mm-hmm. Does that provide any more evidence? And what's your sense of UFOs in a realistic sense as a scientist?
I mean, so I'd say I don't most, you know, calm scientists don't dismiss UFOs out of hand, because we just talked about the Fermi question. Where are they? That's a well-posed question. And if you're going to say that there could be advanced intelligent life beyond our capabilities out there, why wouldn't it visit? So it's a fair question. Scientists, to use Carl Sagan's phrase, extraordinary claims, and that is an extraordinary claim, require extraordinary evidence. And the evidence you were alluding to is not extraordinary evidence. Unfortunately, there's ample evidence, and just ask any trial lawyer about this, that eyewitnesses are even highly trained eyewitnesses are notoriously unreliable. And that's not because they make things up or are delusional. It's just because it's very easy to be misled by what you think you see, or misinterpret it, or have incomplete information. And that's true of even Navy pilots or trained scientists or forensic scientists. So that kind of evidence I can't take seriously enough. Physical evidence, that's what astronomers would want. You know, show me an artifact. Show me a thing that we can inspect in the lab. Show me a thing, because scientific information is information that's shared, that's communal, that's not kept secret, that's published, and that passes muster with other communities of people skeptically looking at it. And no UFO evidence has ever met that bar. So my mind's open, but I'm skeptic.
If you haven't seen it, you haven't seen the YouTube.
Not that one, no.
Okay, well, we'll show it to you when we get off the air for half a second. Okay. It's a thing that's being recorded, right. And you got their voices, et cetera, et cetera. We've got another caller coming in. Roy, you're on the air. I have a question for Professor Impey.
Yes, good morning. You were discussing some of the elements that are possible for life in like various places around the solar system. But one of the things you did not mention was the amount of oxygen. You know, like, wouldn't that be a really big factor in whether there is existing life or possibility of life?
Yes, oxygen is an important telltale. So if you do the thought experiment of what happened if the life on Earth died overnight, the whole biosphere just shut down, the oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere that was generated by microbes billions of years ago would disappear in a couple of million years. It would just dissolve in seawater and rust things and bind with rock. So oxygen is unstable, and since it was produced here by life, it's a good thing to look for elsewhere to see a sign of life. So astronomers are approaching the experiment where they'll sniff the atmospheres of distant exoplanets that are Earth-sized to look for oxygen, because it'll be this great telltale of our form of biology.
So what would be the minimal, you know, amount of oxygen you guys would be looking for?
I think it would be like
a really small percentage or a greater than 1%?
Yeah, that's a good question. So geologists will point out that you can have naturally occurring free oxygen just from geological processes. So I think the actual answer to your question is under a couple of percent. It could just happen through pure geology with no biology involved. If you get beyond 5% or up towards our level of 18%, obviously biology is implicated. But I'll also point out that there was a time on the Earth when there was no oxygen, but there was life. Life used to have a methane-based metabolism, so you might want to look for methane, and there may be other gases or tracers for life that you might want to look for. I mean, look for oxygen, but astronomers, astrobiologists are going to look for other things too.
Thanks, Roy. It's a great question. Let me pose something for you, Chris. If, as I understand it, what they call the great oxidation event, where some cellular creature gave off oxygen and multiplied itself and helped create our atmosphere and changed and contributed, I suppose, also to, at that time, a kind of global warming. Mightn't we be the same sort of repeat of that, another organism, much more complex, and in our activity, we give off, not directly, but through our industry and fossil fuels, that, and are we not creating just another world within which other kinds of creatures might arise, rather than the end of all things and the Venus-like electric blanket that seems to smother everything, as the present Anthropocene idea simply is, the end of everything is coming. Might it just be another transition to life forms?
Sure. And in the distance, before we were on the scene, life was competing with life. So the oxygen-producing organisms outcompeted the methane-producing organisms, and that's why we have an oxygen atmosphere. And it's because photosynthesis is an incredibly efficient process, so life sort of stumbled probably into this incredibly efficient energy production mechanism or usage mechanism. But yes, in the future, something different might happen. So an evolving, you know, planet with life on it will have various dramatic events that involve the natural selection of microbes, actually. Now, we're, of course, controlling, we're sort of driving the machine now, and so the carbon dioxide rise is going to have an effect on other parts of the biosphere. And it's not going to be bad for everything. There will obviously be some microbial forms of life or life in the oceans that are immune from what's happening in the atmosphere, that don't care and just do quite well and maybe do even better because of the new circumstance.
I don't read science fiction, but I suddenly had an idea for a science fiction. Methane-based organisms give way to oxygen-based organisms. That's us. And then after the Anthropocene, let's say we don't self-discipline enough to change it, gives rise to some other kind of things. We've just gotten another call to take a break. Stick with us. We're going to talk about what cosmologists think the universe will be like when it comes to an end. We're back. Smart Talk with Al and my guest, Chris Impey, Distinguished Professor of Astronomy here at the U of A, 790-2040. That's the call-in number. Give us a call and ask Chris a question. Well, you know, we're running towards the end of the show here. Folks, don't leave because we got saving the best for last. And I was reading the end of your book, Einstein's Monsters, The Life and Times of Black Holes, and the following was written by you, and I want you to comment on what you think it might mean in a larger sense. The universe seems to be expanding at a faster rate, not steady state or slower. Eventually, stars, which are little nuclear explosions on fuel, will eventually die out, and pretty soon there will be everywhere empty, cold blackness. From what we've seen, that's a reasonable hypothesis. I get that. So let me jump ahead to the Big Bang, or jump back to the Big Bang. If the present universe goes to nothing, what possibly do you folks in that business think was the goop, the schmutz, the stuff that had to come together to explode to create the Big Bang? Where did that come from?
So that's a...
What do I have right and what do I have wrong? Straighten me out.
That's right, but that's a big... It's a great and unanswered question. So cosmology, unfortunately, the Big Bang model, as successful as it is, and it is really successful, it really only describes a chronology from an initial very hot, very dense state 13.8 billion years ago. And it does really well at describing that chronology. And as you suggested, projecting the future based on current circumstance. But the Big Bang does not include a description of what caused it or what came before it or what the state of space and time was before the Big Bang. It's just an operational description of what happened. That's a little frustrating because physicists like philosophers want to ask the why question. Well, why did it happen or how did it happen? And unfortunately, the model is not good enough to answer that question. So there's speculation that there were precursor states or multiverse idea where there are parallel universes, other space-times that happen, and that these space-times come and go, and it's endless time. So take away Big Bang as the beginning of all time and just posit it as an event in endless time. That sounds nice. That sounds kind of Eastern mystical. It's possible, but there's no evidence to support it. So it's just an evocative idea that bounces around in cosmology.
Does God become as plausible a working hypothesis as it's always been there? I don't know.
So, cosmology and science in general is mute to religion, and so is mute to some agent that causes the universe. It's interesting to me that in the history of Western science, there have been, of course, Eastern religions that have endless time and don't have a sort of deity, a single deity motive force behind the universe. Western science and Western religion sort of went in tandem in positing an origin. So the scientists have their origin story, the Big Bang, and Western religions have their origin story in Genesis and history of the universe and a sort of moral overlay for the evolution of the universe and humanity in it. There's a little parallel there, but they're not really connected because scientists don't need to. God is a sort of unnecessary hypothesis, is one way to put it. However, I work with Jesuit astronomers who do both. They wear both hats.
Right. But as a working hypothesis, is it as plausible? So take the Eastern one. When you think about it, it really is an explanation, but a non-explanation. Well, it just keeps going. Where does it come from? Well, it's always been there. Well, why is that any better than God? I mean, when you think about it, or we just do the Big Bang and then we don't think because that becomes something called religion. But as a working hypothesis, it strikes me that you could say, if you want to posit before every all things, since I don't have any scientific answer, you want to do God, that's fine. You want to do it, keeps going, whatever it is, that's fine. You want to just start the Big Bang because we don't know and you don't want to think about it, that's fine too. But it is not inherently, as the prime mover, any less valid than the thing just keeps going. I mean, what's the greatness? That's silly.
Right. So cosmology does include ideas for what generated the Big Bang. The basic idea is that the pure vacuum of space, you can borrow energy from the vacuum of space, and that's standard physics. Heisenberg's physics uncertainty principle is behind that. So you can borrow energy from a vacuum sufficient to inflate a universe of our size and scale. So there is an idea that's a physical mechanism for how the universe came into be and grew to the way it is and it's heading off into the future. In terms of a deity or an underlying entity, again, in science, that's ascribing extra qualities that are beyond physical law, because as soon as you have a creator, you have a, you know, someone with obviously absolute and arbitrary control over the universe that they created, and then you lead that leads to questions of theodicy and why is there evil in the world and why, etc. So there's a whole chain of questions.
It opens a can of worms.
It opens a can of worms. Scientists just try and keep it simple and say, well, we hold by physical law that we can test in the laboratory as well. We hope, and we've pushed that physical law and its explanations as close to the Big Bang as possible, and maybe even include a mechanism for the Big Bang. But as for that, we can't ask the before question yet. Maybe we will one day, but we'll just stick to our physical law because that's what we're trained to do. That's what we can do as scientists.
So along with that of you, which is a scientist just sticking with physical law, you are also a teacher, not just of U of A students, but of Buddhist monks. Have you learned from them any help in your science work? And tied to that, why does it seem like Oppenheimer naming a cyclotron, et cetera, after Shiva or after something Eastern, why does there seem to be more of a match between the Eastern worldview and science than the Western, well, religious worldview and science?
Well, I think the Eastern worldview it just happens to map onto modern cosmology very well, because cosmology does include the possibility of precursor states or endless inflation where there are parallel universes and they come and go. It's not a tested idea, but it's there. And that's very similar to the endless worlds of Buddhist cosmology. Buddhist cosmology involves enormous physical scales and time scales of billions or even trillions of years. So it's commensurate with scientific view of things. And that means, you know, when you're teaching Buddhist monks or they're having dialogue with them, they're very comfortable with all the ideas of modern cosmology, and they ask, you know, very meaningful and very philosophical questions about it. So they push you as a scientist to those hard questions that you can't answer, where you have to be, you know, you have to be man enough to say, I don't know, or, you know, we don't know. It's an early game. We've only had science for a few hundred years. So it's exciting to teach them in that way. They also have a cosmology that involves the possibility of many life forms, where we don't have to be the most advanced life form. Western religion is, of course, very anthropocentric. It really posits some special status to humanity, and Eastern religion doesn't do that. Eastern religion, of course, doesn't have a deity. It doesn't have theology. It doesn't have dogma, things you have to believe to be an adherent to that religion. So It's light on the pedal on some of that stuff that makes it a little more comfortable.
More comfortable for scientists. Dark matter is stuff or not that's most of 75%, 80% of the universe, but because it doesn't emit light or reflect light, we don't see it. What in God's name is the best guess you could give us? Is this dark matter stuff, and how does it really matter?
We've had 50 years of growing evidence that there's stuff out there that exerts gravity but doesn't shine, doesn't emit light or react with light at all. And so you can't see it directly. That makes it hard to study except by its gravity. That evidence has increased steadily over time. It hasn't got weaker. And it comes from many different venues and avenues and types of measurements. So it's not going to go away. So astronomers possibly could be mistaken about the existence of something they call dark matter, but it's unlikely. And then the question becomes, what is it? And why is there more of it than the normal stuff? And we haven't answered that question. We've ruled some things out, and that's important too. Sometimes, like in a detective story, elimination is important too. So it's not black holes, it's not planets free-floating in space, it's not tiny dust particles. We've ruled out a lot of the big stuff, and really all that's left and where the finger points now is a subatomic fundamental particle. And conveniently, in the world of physics, there are frontier ideas of physics where there are possibly new subatomic fundamental particles that would fit the bill to be the dark matter that astronomers have measured. So people are tentatively optimistic that this issue will be resolved and we'll know what it is. But the experiments to nail it down are actually really difficult. And they've been going for 5 or 6 years, and, you know, we haven't got an answer yet.
Multiverses. Do you believe in that?
It's a fun idea out of cosmology, and it really relates to the fact that the Big Bang was a quantum event. So in the modern cosmology, in the conventional cosmology, the universe was once smaller than an atom, and so the energy that gave rise to our expanding large universe could have been a quantum fluctuation. And so if you had one, why not many? And they're random, and they could have different physical properties, hence the multiverse. So it's an evocative idea. Testing it would require us to show other universes out there, and then you have a problem, because in principle they may not be observable. We're sort of locked in our space-time.
Right. So our biological essence, which lets us do lots of things, also blinds us to things. So if there is a parallel universe comprised not just of dark matter, but let's say dark people, not in the negative sense of evil, but just non-seeing,
right,
there is conceivably a parallel universe populated with parallel people and parallel dynamics.
Yes. And I actually like the Star Trek idea. I forget which episode. The one where we look for things on our time scale. We're used to human time scale. So there were Star Trek where there's these super fast living organisms, and they made just this little whiny sound as they flitted around our world, but we couldn't see them because we deal with seconds and hours and minutes and years. So maybe biology can operate on a time scale that's alien to us.
You can see why astronomy and cosmology is so fascinating. It's both practical and down to earth, and also deals with the most ultimate of questions. There's the music. That means we got to go. Come back. More Smart Talk with Al in a couple of weeks. Chris, thanks for being on the show.
It's great to be on the show.
Gotta have you back.
Bye.